Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Have you ever read a book that doesn't just give you information, but actually sort of shifts how you see everything?
That's definitely the experience we're diving into today. We're tackling Yuval Noah Harari's huge work, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. I mean, it's epic in scope, covering, what, 70,000 years?
Yeah, it's massive. And our goal today really is to give you the essence, the most powerful ideas from it. We're hitting that big question, how did we Homo sapiens, you know, this fairly unremarkable ape species, end up basically running the planet?
And crucially, why does looking back like this matter so much right now? Especially with, well, all the technology shifts we're facing. Mm. Harari essentially reframes the entire human story. And he reveals this maybe surprising core truth. Our dominance isn't really about being stronger or smarter individually. It's built almost entirely on our unique knack for creating and believing in, well, shared stories, collective imagination.
Shared stories. Okay, let's hold on to that.
Before we jump into that whole 70,000-year journey, maybe we should quickly introduce the guide, Yuval Noah Harari. He's an Israeli historian, public intellectual, started out in medieval military history at Oxford, actually.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, but then he made this big shift into what some people call macro history or big history.
I like that, big history, because it signals he's not just about, you know, kings and battles.
Right.
He's pulling together biology, anthropology, economics.
Exactly. Philosophy, too. It gives him this incredibly high-level view of the whole human project.
Yeah, like looking down from space, almost.
Precisely. And what makes his viewpoint so distinct is often described as this kind of detached, almost alien objectivity. Mm. He looks at these huge human systems, democracy, capitalism, religion, with the same kind of, let's say, dispassionate curiosity a biologist might use for an ant colony.
So he's not really judging them. He just wants to know how they work.
Right. What are the rules everyone's following, often unconsciously? And why do billions of people play along?
That curiosity, I think, is why Sapiens became such a phenomenon. And it wasn't just a one-off, right? He followed it up with Homo Deus looking at the future.
Yeah, Homo Deus on technology and humanity's future, and then 21 Lessons to the 21st Century, which tackles, you know, current global issues. He's really become a major voice.
Okay, so let's get to the absolute core argument of Sapiens. Harari's central point is that Homo sapiens took over the world not because we're physically imposing or even because individual sapiens were geniuses, but because we developed this unique ability to create and believe in collective fictions.
Collective fictions. He also calls them imagined realities, right?
Yes, exactly. Imagined realities. It sounds almost too simple. Like, we won because we're good at make-believe.
Well, in a fundamental way, yes. Think about how other primates cooperate. Chimps, for example. They can coordinate, sure, but only within a relatively small group, maybe up to 150 or so.
Right, because it's all based on personal relationships. Who knows who's the boss, who owes who a favor?
Exactly. Intimate personal knowledge, that's their natural ceiling. But humans, we can get millions, even billions of complete strangers to cooperate on incredibly complex projects.
Like building a cathedral or fighting a war or running a global corporation.
Precisely. And they can do it because they all believe in the same invented concepts, the same shared myths, things like the nation, the rule of law, the value of money, the existence of Google as a legal entity.
Things that aren't physically real, but we all agree to act as if they are.
That's the key. And the book basically tracks how this ability unfolded across three major and often really counterintuitive historical turning points.
So what are they?
First, the cognitive revolution. That's where we got the ability for this fictive language. Second, the agricultural revolution, which maybe controversially he labels history's biggest fraud.
Whoa, okay. We'll definitely need to unpack that one.
Oh, we will. And third, the scientific revolution, which was sparked by something really quite radical, admitting we don't know everything.
It's such a compelling way to structure history.
Yeah.
And it really does challenge those, you know, standard narratives of constant human progress we usually get, forces you to ask some pretty deep ethical questions about where we're heading now.
Okay, let's dive into that first big one then. The cognitive revolution. This is roughly, what, 70,000 years ago. Harari connects it to something called the tree of knowledge mutation. Hmm. A chance genetic tweak in our brains.
Yeah, something like that. A random genetic shift. But the crucial thing isn't just that it happened, but what it enabled.
Which was?
Fictive language. And this isn't just, you know, having more words than Neanderthals. It's the ability to talk about things that aren't physically present or real.
So not just, look, a lion or
yeah.
there's the river, but also things like tribal spirits or national identities or legal rights or the concept of a limited liability corporation. Peugeot, he uses it as an example.
Peugeot, the car company, how does that fit in?
Well, Peugeot, the company, doesn't physically exist, right? It's a legal fiction, a story we all agree on, that allows this entity to own property, sue people, employ thousands. It exists purely in our shared imagination.
Got it. So the real magic wasn't just language, but language that could create these shared, well, myths, shared stories.
Exactly, shared myths. And that was the game changer. Because suddenly you could get thousands of sapiens who'd never met to trust each other and work together, all because they believed in the same god or the same leader or the same set of rules.
Which other animals just couldn't do.
Not on that scale or with that flexibility. So when sapiens spread out of Africa and met, say, Neanderthals, Neanderthals might have been bigger, stronger individually.
But we could coordinate better, organize hunting parties, share information about distant resources.
Precisely. Better logistics, larger numbers working together. We basically outcompeted and, yeah, likely wiped out the other human species, largely because our cooperation scaled up, thanks to these shared fictions.
Wow. Okay, that totally sets the stage for the next big shift he talks about, the agricultural revolution around 10,000 BCE. And you mentioned he calls this history's biggest fraud. That sounds deliberately provocative. I mean, wasn't farming the foundation of civilization?
That's the story we usually tell ourselves, yes.
Yeah.
But Harari argues it was actually a really bad deal for the average person. A slow, insidious trap.
A trap? How so?
He makes the case that we didn't domesticate wheat and rice. They domesticated us.
Okay, explain that.
Well, think about it.
Yeah.
Farming meant incredibly hard, repetitive labor, back-breaking work compared to the varied life of a forager. It also meant a much narrower, less nutritious diet, mostly just grains.
Leading to vitamin deficiencies and...
Yeah, exactly. And vulnerability. If your single crop failed because of drought or pests, you face starvation. Hunter-gatherers had a more diverse food base. They were generally more resilient, often healthier, maybe even happier day to day.
So why did we do it if life was arguably better before?
That's the luxury trap.
Yeah.
It wasn't a conscious decision. It happened gradually. Maybe settling down briefly to tend a wild patch of grain seemed convenient.
A small improvement.
A small improvement. But then you invest more time, you develop slightly better tools, you clear more land, and crucially, the reliable calories, even if less nutritious, allowed the population to grow.
Ah.
And once the population density increased, there was simply no going back. You couldn't feed everyone by foraging anymore. You were trapped,
yeah.
stuck with harder work just to maintain the larger population.
The luxury became a necessity that demanded more sacrifice.
Precisely. And with settled populations and agricultural surpluses, you know, stored grain, you suddenly needed much more complex social structures to manage it all.
Right. Who owns the land? Who gets the surplus grain? How do you resolve disputes?
Exactly. And this is where those imagined orders we talked about become really elaborate. You need laws, property rights, social hierarchies.
More fiction.
More fiction, yes. He points to things like the Code of Hammurabi from ancient Babylon. It's a classic example of an imagined order, a set of rules, supposedly divinely ordained, that justified a rigid class system. Nobles, commoners, slaves. All with different rights and values.
Totally arbitrary rules from an objective standpoint.
Completely arbitrary. But if everyone believes in them, they become incredibly powerful social realities that structure society.
Okay, so we went from small bands cooperating through myths to larger farming communities trapped by agriculture but managed by more complex myths. How did we get from there to, well, here, a globalized world?
That's the next phase Harari outlines, the unification of humankind. How did these scattered, diverse agricultural societies start to merge and interact on a much larger scale?
He talks about the three great unifiers, right?
That's right. Three major imagined orders that started to pull humanity together. The first one, money.
Money. The ultimate story we all agree on.
Isn't it just, it's maybe the most successful shared myth ever created. Think about it. Money doesn't care about your religion, your nationality, your politics.
A dollar bill works the same way for everyone, everywhere, basically.
It's the most universal and efficient system of mutual trust we've ever come up with. Why do you accept a piece of paper, or now just digital bits, in exchange for something valuable, like your labor or a house?
Because I trust that someone else will accept it from me later.
Exactly. It's trust in the system, trust that everyone else trusts too. It instantly bridges massive cultural divides.
Okay, so money is one unifier. What's the second?
Empires. Now, empires were obviously often brutal, built on conquest and oppression. Harari doesn't romanticize them at all.
Right.
But, he argues, they played a huge role in unification through standardization. Empires imposed common laws, common languages, common weights and measures, common currency across vast, previously diverse regions.
Forcing people into a shared framework.
Yes. And over time, this often created larger shared identities. People started thinking of themselves as Roman or Chinese or whatever identities that sometimes outlasted the empire itself. It melted down smaller local cultures into bigger, more unified ones.
Okay, money, empires, and the third unifier.
Universal religions. Think Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, unlike earlier tribal or local deities that only cared about their people in their place.
These religions claimed to have truths that applied to everyone, everywhere.
Exactly. They were inherently missionary. Their goal was to convert all of humankind. This created massive transnational communities of believers, the Christian Ecumen, the Islamic Ummah people united by shared beliefs and rituals, transcending political borders and ethnic differences.
So these three forces, money, empires, and universal religions, gradually wove humanity together, creating the potential for a truly global civilization.
Which brings us closer to the modern world and the final major revolution, the scientific revolution, kicking off around 500 years ago.
And you said the key here was something surprising. Admitting ignorance.
Yeah, that's Harari's really interesting take. He argues that what truly distinguishes the modern era isn't just new discoveries, but a fundamentally different attitude towards knowledge. The discovery of ignorance.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, pre-modern traditions, whether religious or philosophical, tended to assume that all the really important stuff was already known. It was written down in sacred texts or ancient wisdom. If you had a big question, the answer was believed to already exist.
You just had to find the right passage or interpret the tradition correctly.
Right. But modern science started from a radically different and actually quite humble premise.
Yeah.
We don't know. We admit our ignorance about most things. And that admission, the willingness to say, I don't know, let's find out, became the driving force of progress.
So it wasn't just finding answers, it was embracing the questions and admitting we lacked answers.
Yes. But crucially, science didn't achieve its power in isolation. It wasn't just curious scholars in labs.
Okay.
It formed a powerful, mutually beneficial alliance with two other major forces of the modern era, which empire and capitalism. Think about it. Scientific research, especially exploration and technological development, is incredibly expensive. Who funded Columbus or Captain Cook?
Governments, empires. Looking for new lands, resources, trade routes.
Exactly. Empire provided the funding and the practical motivation for a lot of scientific exploration, which in turn often served imperial goals, mapping territories, finding resources, developing military tech.
And how does capitalism fit in?
Capitalism provided the other essential ingredient, the belief in future growth and the mechanism of credit. The capitalist creed says that investing resources now will generate more resources in the future. This justified lending vast sums of money credit to finance risky scientific ventures and technological innovations, believing they would eventually pay off handsomely.
So it's this feedback loop. Science creates new possibilities, empire exploits them for power, and capitalism funds it all based on the promise of future profits.
Precisely. A powerful engine that has dramatically reshaped the world in just a few centuries. And this rapid acceleration leads Harari to his rather sobering conclusion about our present and future.
Which is?
He suggests we might be approaching the end of Homo sapiens as we've known ourselves. Not necessarily extinction, but transformation.
How so?
Through technologies like genetic engineering, biotechnology, artificial intelligence, we are moving from being shaped by slow, blind, natural selection to potentially taking control of our own evolution. We're gaining the power of intelligent design over life itself.
Designing our successors, essentially.
Potentially, yes. Moving beyond the biological limitations that have defined us for millennia.
Okay, so we've taken this huge tour through 70,000 years. What does it all actually mean for us sitting here today? What are the big takeaways?
I think the most fundamental one, the one that really sticks with you, is the overwhelming power of shared myths. Realizing just how much of our reality is built on these collective fictions.
It's not just an abstract historical concept, is it?
Yeah.
It's totally practical. Right. Take Harari's example of the Peugeot company. It's such a brilliant illustration. Where is Peugeot? It's not the factories, not the cars, not the employees.
It's a story. A legal fiction written down on paper, registered with governments. It exists purely because we lawyers, customers, investors, employees, all collectively agree to treat it as if it's real.
And this purely imaginary entity can own billions in real assets, employ hundreds of thousands of real people, sign real contracts. If everyone simultaneously decided tomorrow that Peugeot wasn't real anymore, poof, it vanishes.
Even if the factories are still standing, it really makes you look around and ask, what other powerful entities in my life, corporations, nations, ideologies, are held together purely by a story we all agree to believe?
Yeah, it definitely changes how you see things, which leads straight into the second big theme, I think, challenging the progress narrative.
Especially with that agricultural revolution as fraud idea.
Exactly. If that huge shift actually made life worse for most people, maybe we should question our modern assumptions about progress, too. Are we caught in new versions of the luxury trap?
Like what?
Well, you know, the constant drive for more convenience, the bigger house, the faster phone, the next promotion. Are these things genuinely making us happier or more satisfied in the long run?
Or are they just creating new pressures, new anxieties, new demands on our time and energy, trapping us in a cycle of working harder for diminishing returns and actual well-being?
That's a really good question to ask ourselves, which brings up theme three. Happiness as the forgotten metric of history.
Yeah, Harari spends quite a bit of time on this. He suggests maybe we haven't actually gotten much happier over the millennia.
How come?
He leans towards a biological view that happiness is largely governed by our biochemistry, our expectations. We might achieve something we desperately wanted.
Like getting that new phone.
Right. And there's a brief spike of pleasure, but then our baseline resets. Our expectations adjust upwards. We adapt.
So, is it possible that, biochemically speaking, our potential range for happiness hasn't changed much since the Stone Age? We just have different stuff to be happy or unhappy about.
That's the provocative idea. Are we, despite all our technological marvels, potentially just as prone to dissatisfaction as a Paleolithic forager, just worrying about different things? It really makes you rethink what the goal of all this progress actually is. And Harari is just so good at boiling these huge ideas down into really memorable, punchy lines.
Yeah, some quotes really stick.
Like the absolute core concept. Any large-scale human cooperation is rooted in common myths that exist only in people's collective imagination. That just sums up the central thesis perfectly.
And then the one that shocks you awake, the agricultural revolution was history's biggest fraud. It was a trap. You can't forget that one easily.
Definitely gets your attention. And on the power of those fictions in practice, money is the most universal and most efficient system of mutual trust ever devised. It highlights how something totally invented can become so incredibly powerful and practical.
And then looking forward, that really quite chilling warning about our growing power. Is there anything more dangerous than dissatisfied and irresponsible gods who don't know what they want?
That one gives you pause, doesn't it? Especially thinking about AI and genetic engineering. Gods who don't know what they want. A very sobering thought for our times.
So, okay, this is all fascinating, mind-bending stuff. But how can you actually use these insights from Sapiens day to day?
Well, I think the most immediate benefit is application one, enhanced critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have this framework of imagined orders and shared myths,
you start seeing them everywhere.
Exactly. You suddenly become much more aware of how stories are used in media, in advertising, in politics. When someone talks about national interest or market forces or corporate values,
you recognize them as powerful fictions designed to persuade, to mobilize, to justify certain actions or power structures. You can kind of deconstruct the narrative.
Absolutely. It gives you a new lens for analyzing the world. And this applies professionally too. Application two, business and strategy.
How so?
Think about it. What is corporate culture? What are mission statements, brand identities? They are essentially the modern imagined orders of the business world.
They're the shared myths that get thousands of employees who might otherwise have nothing in common to cooperate towards abstract goals like increasing market share or delivering shareholder value.
Understanding how these narratives function is pretty crucial for anyone involved in leadership or organizational design. And finally, on a broader level, I think it fosters application three, global citizenship.
How does that work?
Well, if you truly internalize that all nations, all ideologies, even our deeply held beliefs about human rights, are ultimately human inventions, powerful and important inventions, but inventions nonetheless.
It kind of takes the wind out of absolute certainty and tribalism, maybe.
Exactly. It fosters a sense of humility. It highlights our shared identity as a single species, Homo sapiens, facing common global challenges like climate change or pandemics. It reminds us we're all part of the same relatively recent historical story, and we have this huge, often devastating impact on the planet.
That sense of shared fate as a species is maybe one of the most important takeaways.
For me, the final thought that really resonates is how empowering this perspective can be, even though it's also kind of sobering.
How do you mean?
Well, if our reality, our societies, our economies are largely shaped by the stories we collectively choose to believe, then it follows that if we can change the stories, we can potentially change the reality.
We're not just passive products of history. We're also the authors of the next chapter.
Right. If we can consciously choose better stories, more inclusive stories, more sustainable stories, maybe we can actually steer things in a better direction. That feels hopeful in a way.
It does. Although that leads right back to Harari's most provocative question, doesn't it? The one that really lingers after you finish the book.
Which is?
As we gain these almost godlike powers, designing life, creating artificial intelligence, reshaping the planet, the crucial question isn't just, what do we want to become?
The deeper, harder question is, what do we want to want? How do we cultivate the wisdom, the foresight, the ethical grounding to handle the immense power we're developing? Especially when, as he points out, we still have basically the same Stone Age emotions and cognitive biases.
That gap between our technological power and our wisdom.
That gap is maybe the central challenge of the 21st century. How do we learn to want the right things before our power outstrips our understanding? It's a question Sapiens leaves us grappling with long after the last page.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.